Beginning tomorrow, PBS will premiere the first of a four-part series co-hosted by Stephen Johnson, titled Extra Life, A Short History of Living Longer. The series and the companion book are set in the context of today's COVID-19 crisis and explores the lessons learned from previous global pandemics and reveals how a public health revolution was launched. Johnson looks at the milestones of this progress, from the discoveries of vaccines and antibiotics to the introduction of things that are now commonplace. Johnson also turns his analytical eye to the present. Do we risk regressing in life expectancy as our public health systems face unprecedented challenge, such as the one we're living through? Are we overlooking any current technologies or field of research that will enable us to live even longer than we do now? Stephen Johnson has a busy month ahead. The PBS series begins tomorrow. The new book is out, Extra Life, A Short History of Living Longer, and he will be giving a talk at the Salisbury Forum, for the Salisbury Forum, called Extra Life. It's a Zoom webinar. A Zoom webinar, which will be happening on May 26th at 7:30, and you can find out more at salisburyforum.org. Salisburyforum.org, and I'll give that information at the end of the program as well. Stephen Johnson, welcome back. It's great to have you on the program once again.
Oh, always great to be here.
So what got you thinking in this particular way?
You know, this project is funny. It's 4 years old. I started thinking about this as a book and potentially a TV series I think 2017. And the idea I had was that we would be, if it came out around 2020 or 2021, it would be about the 100-year anniversary of the end of the Spanish flu, the great influenza, the last, great pandemic that swept right around the world. And that seemed an appropriate marker because it really is the last point that life expectancy globally declined for a stretch of time. And since that point, we have basically doubled global life expectancy. It was roughly, depending on how you measure it, in the United States, it was around 42. Today, it's somewhere around 77, 78. And that seemed to be a good milestone because it was really going to be a story about how we did that. That doubling of life expectancy is just this extraordinary thing that we pulled off as a species. And I wanted to kind of celebrate that and learn from it and try and figure out what the lessons were. And from the beginning, the idea was, well, vaccines are a huge part of that. And a major story is the eradication of smallpox. And so a mass vaccination effort that led to the eradication of smallpox was always going to be a big part of it. And when I thought of it as a show, I thought episode one will probably be about vaccines and about mass vaccination. And then all of a sudden, the whole project got, I'd basically written the book by the beginning of 2020, but we hadn't made the show yet. And all of a sudden, we were sitting as COVID started erupting around the world in the beginning of last year. We realized that it was, it was a different kind of story, but it was, bizarrely timely, kind of tragically timely. And so here we are now. And, the first episode is all about vaccines and vaccination efforts. So we're kind of, the way I've come to think of it is that it's like a 200-year history of right now. Like all the things that are the most important forces shaping the world right now, this is their backstory.
So when we look at that backstory, what does it tell us ultimately about life expectancy and this idea of extra life?
Well, it's a couple of, key things. I mean, the first is that we are capable of amazing progress. And it's a hard progress to measure because there's this paradox about progress in health, which is that it's measured in non-events. It's measured in terrible things that didn't happen or that stopped happening. So other forms of progress, like a smartphone or a skyscraper, you see it, right? You're like, look, the world didn't used to have smartphones, and now they do, and that's progress. But with health, it's like the progress is the smallpox infection that you didn't get when you were five, the cholera contaminated water that you didn't drink 20 years ago and die from. And so we forget right? We forget that we've made these incredible achievements. And one of the most profound ones, I think, is just how dangerous childhood was. You know, if you read any of the great 19th century novels, you can see this. You know, the children are just dying all the time. But 40% of children died before reaching adulthood, you know, really until the 20th century, no matter where you were. And that is such a transformative thing. Childhood went from being, you know, the most deadly time of your life until you were very old to being the safest point of your life. And think about that, what that means for the experience of being a child and the experience of being a parent. It's just an extraordinary thing.
So, you know, for you having immersed yourself in the subject for 4 years prior, and then in February of last year, as all of this starts to emerge, how, I mean, were you able to say, oh, well, this is probably what's going to happen? here we go. Or were you on the edge of your seat as much as the rest of us?
Well, I think it was kind of both. I mean, I do think, having written about, you know, years ago, I think we might have even talked about it when it came out. I wrote this book called The Ghost Map about cholera,
right,
in the 19th century. And,
yep.
And I had been around and thought about the ending of Ghost Map, talks extensively about a future global pandemic and what it would mean, and a lot of things that, you know, that ended up happening with COVID. And so, you know, I certainly wasn't alone. There are a lot of people who have been thinking about this for far longer than I have, who knew that this was going to happen. It was inevitable that there was going to be a major respiratory pandemic, respiratory virus pandemic that was going to happen. And so, you know, there was a sense watching it in February and March. I mean, I saw at the end of the vaccines episode, there's a wonderful long interview we do with Larry Brilliant, who played a role in the eradication of smallpox, who's just an amazing voice on this. And I'm kind of friends with Larry, and I saw him in January, late January, in California of 2020. And the first thing he said to me was like, are you tracking this Wuhan virus?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I thought they didn't have human-to-human transmission. And he was like, no, they do. And I was like, oh, man, if Larry is freaked out about it, then I got to be freaked out about it. So I was definitely – and the other thing was, I was in New York with my family. And so I was in New York with my family. We were right in the middle of it. And so it was very it was a stressful time. But I was also, you know – I was hard at work on the show and trying to make it happen. And then we had the problem of trying to make a television series in the middle of the pandemic, which was challenging enough.
When it comes to the global aspect of this, I mean, we obviously look at our history and how we're handling this case, how we handled the flu in 100 years ago. But how do we have a how are we linked now with the rest of the world, as, yes, this is a global pandemic that is wreaking havoc. Even though our numbers are down, we still see portions of South America and India with numbers that are staggering, and we don't know where that's going to hit next. We still are dealing with the issue of vaccination and variants and big question marks that remain. So I guess,
yeah,
go ahead.
Well, I think it's a great question. I mean, you can't solve a global crisis on a national level. And you particularly can't solve it because of, as you allude to, this, you know, the evolutionary race we're on against viruses, and this particular virus, right, in terms of the variants. And so you can look at someone who's sitting there who's 30 years old and, you know, thinking, well, it's on the wane here in the United States, and I'm probably not much at risk myself personally. Why do I need to get vaccinated? And the answer to that is not just because there might be some older, more at-risk person who you might infect, although that is a big part of the answer. But the other answer is that the longer the virus stays in circulation, the more chance that it evolves in some way that makes it both resistant to the existing vaccines, but also potentially makes it more lethal to 30-year-olds. Right, we're just giving the coronavirus more time to mutate, and that evolutionary time is not. It may be that it evolves to be a less lethal virus, and that often does happen over time. But it may be that it doesn't, and you don't want to take that risk, particularly when you have this extraordinary advantage that was unthinkable just, you know, 5 or 10 years ago in the form of these mRNA vaccines that were developed so quickly, that are so effective and so safe, to not avail yourself of this opportunity, both for yourself and for the world, is just a terrible mistake.
I know you touch on, and I'm interested more than touch on, but really look into the health inequities in this country. How does that play a part in this story?
Well, it's a very interesting thing. I think one of the most surprising things that I learned looking at the long view of human health is that until about 1750, there really wasn't health inequality, really didn't exist. It didn't. You know, there was massive wealth inequality. You know, you had kings and queens, and you had hunter-gatherers and paupers, but and working class. But all that accumulated wealth didn't help you at all in terms of the question of how long you lived or whether your kids made it to adulthood. And it wasn't until life expectancy started to go up for the first time. Basically, average life expectancy until 1750 around the world was 35, and 40% of your kids would die. And then first among the kind of elites of Europe and the United States, and then among the kind of working class, you start to see these increasing lifespans. And that introduces for the first time a gap between the people who live long and the people who don't live long. And that becomes a global gap, right, between kind of the developed world and the developing world, as we used to call it, the global South. Now, that gap got really big by about 1950. You had people living on average into their 70s in Europe and the United States, and you had people in Africa or India who were living on average 25. So that was probably the biggest gap that there ever has been in our history. But over the last 30 years, it's been narrowing, and it's narrowing very quickly, actually. It's a very positive sign. It's still there. There's still a big gap. But, like, for instance, India's average life expectancy is about 69 or something like that. So they've made a huge amount of progress in a very short amount of time. So, you know, when we look at the story of life expectancy, it's both the overall average, but it's also we need to look at it as, in terms of how those benefits are distributed, and they have not historically been distributed equally.
The thought, I just want to go back to one thing. We have a few moments here, and you talk about the what we're facing right now with vaccinations, and you look at this in about vaccines and antibiotics, and I'm curious as to, has there always been the resistance that we're seeing now? Is this part of that history?
Yeah, it's something I think very specific to vaccines. Which I suppose we have to reconcile ourselves to. It's in the nature of a vaccine that you're giving a treatment to someone who is not sick. You know, in other interventions, it's like, well, my child is sick, and so we need to treat him with something so he'll get better. Whereas a vaccine is like you take a perfectly healthy person, and it's particularly wrenching if you're a parent, and say, well, I want to make this intervention, even though they're not infected with anything. They don't, you know, and that anti-vax sentiment is as old as vaccines. There were huge anti-vax movements in the 19th century. And in some ways, they made a little bit more sense in the 19th century because vaccines were a little bit riskier then. Now, they are really just remarkably safe. And so the science is not on the side of the anti-vax movements. But yeah, I think it's a tension that is always going to be there because of the kind of first do no harm idea. Like, why would medical science intervene when someone is healthy with something that carries some tiny amount of risk with it? And we just have to, you know, we just have to trust the data on this one. We can see that, you know, you are more likely to live a healthy life if you're vaccinated with the array of vaccines that we've developed over the last 200 years. And that, you know, getting people to believe in that partially involves telling them these stories about the past and reminding them of how deadly life was. If they're not educated about those stories, they're not reminded of those stories, I think it gets a lot easier to fall back into that kind of anti-science, anti-vax attitude.
So can we overcome those hesitancies on many fronts to allow us to live even longer than we do now?
Well, the big progress will come now at the older age part of the spectrum, right? We've made a lot of progress on keeping children alive. We're not going to get a lot of gains from that. So the question is, not only can people live to 110 or 120, but can they live healthy lives, right? You don't want to just be kept alive on a ventilator until you're 110. You want to be active. And that's a big challenge. We don't really know what the outer boundary of, you know, human life. No one is really, as far as we know, lived past about 125. There's some interesting science that suggests we could push past that boundary. It's still very early stages. But the biggest thing we could do now is fight things like, you know, heart disease and cancer, which we're making a lot of progress on. And, you know, keeping those diseases that kill us in our 70s and 80s, keeping those at bay, that'll increase the average quite a bit.
You are going to be part of the Salisbury Forum on the 26th of May, Wednesday, the 26th at 7:30. You can find out more by going to salisburyforum.org. Also, you can go and check out the new book, which is Extra Life, A Short History of Living Longer. Tomorrow, it begins a four-part PBS series. Stephen Johnson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for chatting.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.